3, 2, 1, see ya.
You're listening to the Beast Life Podcast with your hosts, Randy and Brian.
All right. Welcome to another episode of the Base Life Podcast. Devin, how's it going, man?
It's going great. Thanks again, Randy, for having me a second time.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a lot of fun on that last one with Cyril. And that was like me trying to get my shit together.
When was that?
What was that, winter?
Yeah, well, like 4 months ago. Yeah, I'm just guessing.
It's hard to say, but it was a fun little chat. But during that, I was like, man, I want to peel back this onion layer a little bit more and learn more about you, and I guess share more about you, because we've talked quite a bit about some of these adventures and things since then. But I was just like, this. We need to share this. We need to talk to this. It's an interesting dude right here. Thanks for being willing to come back and chat or meet me again, I guess. We're basically the same location, but
always a pleasure.
Right. It's been a fun weekend, huh?
Yeah, man. Met you guys up at Sandy's up in Sheerboden, or Lager, actually. We were up there chopping wood in the evening yesterday, hike back down, do a podcast real quick, gonna hike back up this evening.
yeah we
still need to buy a new axe handle.
Ooh. Yeah, two actually.
Oh, the no other, the yeah, other one broke too.
It's on its way out. It's getting dangerous.
Shit. All right, we can do that tomorrow and leave them with somebody.
Peggy made traces of to get the right size.
Okay.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. How are we going to figure that one out?
Photo with a penny for scale.
Mm-hmm. Banana for scale.
Yeah. And then we just got to leave the handles with somebody that can pass them off. Because I don't think we can get back up there tomorrow. But
right.
A little bit. Such a neat place. Like, I've been coming here since 2012. And last week was my first time seeing Sandy's farm. And then
it's epic. You know,
fast forward 6 days and we're back up there. It's such a cool place. I mean, you can only hike there. Like, it's
it's proper Alpkäse or Alpen cheese, which has to be made between at a certain elevation. There are standards for which elevations it can be made at. So hers qualifies. And then last year she was tested by the cheese guy of Switzerland, and she got 20 out of 20 points, so she totally nailed it for both the goat cheese and the cow cheese.
Oh, yeah. Wow, I didn't realize it was both. That's awesome.
Yeah, she's award-winning
cheese maker. Yeah, but that's awesome, and a sweet person. I don't even know where to begin, man. And this is usually how it goes. Like, I'll have a podcast with somebody for about an hour or so, hour and a half, and then we stop recording, and then other cool stories come out of the woodwork, and I'm like, and we're like, well, it's a great reason to come back. But after the last podcast, we were walking back or two somewhere, and you were telling me about train hopping across the United States, and I was completely fascinated. So I will stop there and be like, so tell us about train hopping.
What does that mean?
Yeah, and how did you get it? How did this come about? What was going on? Like,
I was 18 and 19, and I wanted to travel, as we all do. I grew up in the U.S. I'm from the United States and had never been. I grew up mostly in New York. I moved around a little bit, but I had never been west of the Mississippi, and I was kind of fascinated with the allure of the West. And one day it kind of dawned on me, you know, in a similar way that base jumping, me getting into base jumping, and I'm sure it's similar for a lot of us, it kind of dawned on me one day, you see these people flying wingsuits on YouTube or whatever, and you're like, they're just people. Like, I could do that. I could be there. And that was how I felt when I was 18 watching, like, photography or looking at photography or watching videos, whatever. You see this, the austerity of the American West. And we all grow up wanting to be a cowboy at some part of our lives, you know? And then one day I just kind of thought to myself, like, I could be there. And I packed up a rucksack, like an old 1970s military style rucksack, and started walking through 12 inches of snow, like 30 centimeters of snow, you know, for metric.
I think we'll all figure it out.
And I walked 12 miles before I came to the first junction of train tracks, where there was a train that was stopped, and I could tell it had recently moved because there was no snow on top of it. I started walking along that train looking for an empty car, and like the first ones I jumped up on, they were locked. They were transport. They were empty cars, but they were the kinds of cars that transport autos, like cars. Suddenly the train started moving, like really slowly, you know, but that's kind of one of the first rules of train hopping. You don't want to jump moving trains if you can avoid it. But this train started moving and I was like, oh, fuck. So I started shuffling my way down through the snow, get to the next junction. I jump up on the junction, like with no safety in mind or anything. And just by absolute luck, the door was open. So I went in to this train car, pulled out my sleeping bag because it was winter. It was like March in upstate New York, going from Rochester to Buffalo. And I pulled out my sleeping bag and I just curled up in it and waited. I fell asleep. The train stopped. I didn't know where I got off. Yeah. And so began like a really long series of pretty much unforgettable adventures, and the kinds of adventures that I think are really formative for young men. It was full of uncertainty, and I think that's kind of one of the bravest things you can do. It's something that we as base jumpers ultimately, in a way, become masters of, or at least very familiar with, this feeling of uncertainty to take the leap. Now, I would also say, though, that uncertainty is mitigated by things like preparation, studying. You arm yourself with all the tools that you might need to mitigate risk as best you can. And I can't say that I studied train hopping, you know, like who yeah. even does that in the 21st century? Like, it's not the Great Depression anymore, you know? So yeah, it was pretty unpopular generally speaking, but by the time I made it to hubs like Chicago, there were a lot of vagabonds, who would do that. And then you have, the bulls, I think they call them still, like the guards of the, freight yards, who would look for vagabonds, for train hoppers, and kind of come and try to beat you up if they could find you, kick you out. So I learned from other, as I got further into the, U.S. or deeper toward the West, the more trains I hopped and whatnot, I came across all kinds of characters, you know, and from, yeah, like, it's kind of like base jumping. I think a lot of the outside world has a perception or this prejudice that everybody who does something is going to be a particular way. Like in base, it's always, oh, they're adrenaline junkies. But I found people who were like PhD level educated, And then all the way down to, well, lots of meth heads, too.
Well, the meth head might be able to teach a PhD person a few things about a
couple cooking. Street smarts.
Yeah, well, or how to get on a certain train or things like that.
Yeah, sure.
Did you have, like, mentors or anything like that, you know, the way we have in skydiving, where, like, people no. showing you how to...
I wouldn't say I had any mentors in that. And I also wouldn't wouldn't consider myself all that adept at that particular thing. There were people who had been hopping for, 20, 40 years. Like,
Jesus.
There were people who had been doing it since the summer of 69 and stuff like that. But I was just kind of making my own way. And the fruits of that effort manifested themselves in California eventually.
How long did it take you to get to Cali?
Well, actually, let's see. Fuck. Took me like maybe like 5 days to get to Chicago. And then from Chicago, I went to see family in Milwaukee. And then from Milwaukee, I was driven across the Mississippi River by my uncle, where I jumped another train and made my way to Denver. It's kind of a long story and all that, but let's see. It
hung out there?
Probably took like 2 weeks, let's say.
Oh, wow.
And by the time I made it to L.A., I was walking down the street as a dirty vagabond, like unshaven, full of train grease. And there's like some, you know, base jumpers are dirty, right? We don't shower.
Base jumpers, climbers, surfers.
Yeah, climbers, like proper dirt baggers. But there's something like uniquely gross about train hopping dirt bags because you get all that muck and grime from the grease of the rails. And so, yeah, I was pretty slimy by the time I was in L.A. And I was walking down the street and whatever. This and that. Anyway, long story.
People like throwing money at you? Like, oh, Jesus.
No, I wish. But I did get $100 and some new clothes and the opportunity to do a photo shoot with a bunch of beautiful California models.
Rewind that a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
So how did that happen?
That's part of the long story.
Yeah, I got time.
Yeah, all right. So I was in L.A., first time ever really being west of the Mississippi. And in L.A., I was walking down the street, I think Sunset Boulevard. And I'd been into, like, some shops. I found this really awesome first editions bookstore called Mystery Pier Bookstore. I'm still friends with them. Like, I was always a literature nerd, you know? So first chance I got, I was like, oh, bookstore, cool. So I went in there, but came out and I told them, actually, next time you see me, I'm going to have written a book and I'm going to give you guys a copy. I did hold true to that promise.
Nice.
But anyway, so after that, I was out on the street and some British guy comes up and he's like, oh, wow. You look so interesting. I have to photograph you. So I was like, okay, sweet. And they offered to pay me $100 and give me free clothes. So I show up to this photo shoot and it was like a actual proper set. There were like 14 beautiful girls all lined up there. There was like this old motorcycle and they were doing like photo shoots. So, they're like, okay, get on the motorcycle, lay back, all that stuff. I was like pretty nervous, but oh, first they clean me up. I should say that. Like,
oh yeah, you gotta bathe first.
Yeah, make this presentable.
I was less than presentable at the moment, but they cleaned me up, got shaved, got put into this like awesome fancy clothes with a nice paisley tie, and I was chilling on the motorcycle with beautiful blonde-haired California girls behind me. And I was only 19 at the time. So I was like, this is living the life, man.
I made it.
And turns out, so later I got an invitation to go to a party at the Playboy Mansion.
Hey.
So.
Right. I was like, is he going to say casting couch or something next? What's happening here? Like,
no, but I will tell you stories about the Playboy Mansion.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Hanging out in the grotto?
Yes, dude. The grotto, the famous. So from the photo shoot, turns out that some affiliate company they were working with was somehow affiliated with Miller or Miller Lite or something, which was hosting a party at the Playboy Mansion. And so I got invited to go. I was able to choose what my wardrobe would be out of the rack that they had there.
So they invited you in. They're like, and you can pick what you want to wear to it.
Yeah, that was my payment. I got $100 and an outfit. And picked like a pretty snazzy outfit, like bright, bold pink dress shirt with a black paisley tie, you know? And
there you go.
And then at first, and I was only 19, so actually, technically, I was only supposed to get a tour of the Playboy Mansion, but, you know, got lost somewhere between like the switching time from when it turned in from the tour into the actual party. Sorry, but
Hugh.
Yeah. So I stayed and I met Hugh's brother, actually. Hugh wasn't there, but I met his brother. I met Kendall, I think was her name. Like the chick.
One of those.
Ones
from the TV ones, show, right?
Sporty Spice.
And then like, so I stay. I start drinking Red Bull vodkas and all that stuff. And I'm getting pretty excited and happy. And there were a lot of models walking around just wearing paint of various designs. So I start getting, I made friends with the DJ's drummer. The DJ was so-called the naked DJ because she would take her top off halfway through the night. She was an ex-playmate and shit like that.
Nice.
So I'm hanging out with the drummer. He was super cool, and he keeps getting me Red Bull vodkas, and I keep asking him to take pictures of me with these models, which, like, in retrospect is pretty cringy, but fuck, I was like a little kid.
You don't know what you don't know, right?
I was pretty baby-faced at the time, too, so I don't think I was, like, hurting my options or anything.
Right.
But, yeah, in the tour, they showed us the game room, which has, like, all these pinball machines and this and that. And then there are these two back rooms off of that. One goes to a room with, like, I can't remember exactly, like, a bed and a couch or something and a box of tissues next to it whatever. And but the other one, you walk in, and it's kind of circular, and it has mirrors. Like, the walls are all mirrors. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you walk in, you sink down because the whole floor is like a foam mattress, like a memory foam mattress.
Wow.
So, and then there are pillows all lining
Nobody's
the mirrors.
Fucking in there.
Right, dude? And so that was like, that became my pursuit. I was like, yeah, I'm going to take somebody back to this movie. Whatever. I was like a dumb baby-faced 19-year-old. So, but then, yeah, later I end up in the grotto and,
sorry, I don't know what the grotto is.
That's like the famous naked cave where the hot tubs are from the pool. And actually, in spirit of the name, I took everything off except my tie. But I was pretty deep on Red Bull vodkas by that point.
Nice.
And then only about a month later, I found myself in prison in Canada.
Oh, fuck.
What?
Wait, what?
Yeah. That's where the book comes in, actually.
So I actually wrote a note here. I was like, so you wrote a book?
Yeah.
Let's hear a little bit about that. And can I get a copy?
Yeah, so, man, for sure.
I'll pay full price. I like.
Okay, it's like $100,000.
So you had some time on your hands to write a book.
Yeah, found myself with some time on my hands. So after hopping freight trains for like a month and a half or whatever the whole ordeal was, out to California, kind of back. Like, I ended up flying back to New York because I felt homesick at the time, especially the day following the Playboy Mansion. I just kind of, like, yeah, I felt like this weird emptiness. The day before, or the couple nights before, I was, like, wandering around through all the ritzy neighborhoods of Hollywood, looking into the windows from the street, like, kind of feeling sorry for myself, blah, blah, blah. Like, oh, I wish I had a warm house and a nice family to come home to. And, yeah, so it all kind of accumulated. And the next day, I felt pretty homesick. So I booked a flight back to New York. But after only, like, a week back in New York, I felt restless again. So I started hitchhiking. And my goal, my idea was to hitchhike to a port city of anywhere and offer to work on a freight ship just to take me somewhere, mm-hmm. like Europe or wherever the hell it was going. I didn't really care. But again, it was that kind of sort of looking back, it's kind of like naivety. But at the time, it was just a willingness to see what else is out there in the world,
sure.
to travel, which I think a lot of us get that travel bug. Mm. But I didn't make it all that far before I was arrested in Quebec. And
for what?
Okay. So
are we allowed to talk about it?
Are we allowed to be honest, like open on the show?
I mean, it's
nothing like it's murder, you know.
You can always cut it out, but I'm curious.
Right? Yeah, because yeah. you got 4 or 5 days to think about it before I actually finish editing this. So if you're like, "Yo, cut this out,"
yeah. So I went up into. So actually, first I hitchhiked to the Adirondack Mountains in upstate New York. And the first thing I did is I stopped there for about 7 days and it was still snow. I brought a 22 Magnum hunting rifle, like a small caliber hunting rifle with me and a one man tent. And I walked about 15 miles off the trail into the High Peaks region of the Adirondacks with my rifle. And a jar of peanut butter, some trail mix, and that was it.
You got some calories.
Yeah, exactly. Quick calories, like peanut butter. You know, I grew up wrestling. Like, I wrestled my mm-hmm. whole life, at least up until that point. And I became really good at calorie counting, you know, from losing weight and all that stuff.
Peanut butter kept me alive my freshman year at the Citadel. Like, yeah, you just needed calories.
Yep. Yeah, it's such a efficient way to get a big boost in calories and fats. But that was kind of like my lifesaver in the sense that if I couldn't catch game to eat, mm-hmm. That was a quick boost in calories, give me enough pick-me-up to go out and hunt again or trap. And so I was living off the land. I set some traps. I did some hunting, just small game like squirrels and rabbits, and lived snares, off of that.
Snares and stuff?
Yeah, snares, squirrel poles.
Squirrel pool? I've never heard
squirrel,
of that.
Pole. Yeah. It's like a little trick. Squirrels are silly in the sense that they will follow another squirrel that's in distress. And you set up like 4 different snares all around a pole, leaning up against a tree or whatever. And if one goes up, falls in the snare. Yeah, this is kind of morbid.
We saw some of those on that reality show.
I mean, I saw snares. I just I've never seen a squirrel pole.
It's basically.
But yeah, so they basically all come.
Yeah, it's just multiple. It's multiple snares. And, whatever. So I did some trapping and, some hunting. And after about like 5 days, I was pretty fucking burned out of that. gets old pretty quick, especially.
I was gonna say, it takes about 5 days and you're like, yeah.
fuck this.
Yeah, and then I, on like day five or six or something, I was like, okay, well, you know, you set out here to do something hard, something difficult, and next to me was the highest peak in New York, which is Mount Marcy. It's not all that high in elevation, but in exposure, it's relatively high. At least for me at the time, I was not an experienced mountaineer or anything. And it's not a technical climb either. It's just a hike. But it was like the end of winter, so still icy and whatever. But I decided to climb that. Climbed up it. Met super interesting guy along the way. We kind of connected. Actually, he took a picture of me on the peak of Mount Marcy, and that picture ended up becoming the cover of the book that I wrote.
Oh, nice. Cool.
So that was cool. And anyway, after that, I endeavored to, so I came back out of the wilderness, back to my truck, and I drove up into, Quebec, into Montreal. And the playoff games were happening for hockey, for NHL. And, my roommate was at the time, like before that, my roommate was a hockey player. And he was like, oh, dude, if you're in Montreal, you got to see the riots. Like every time the Montreal Canadiens team wins or loses, they riot in the streets. It's insane.
It's like an Ohio State fan, basically. Similar.
Yeah. And I'm not one to miss a good riot, you know. So, so I was like, all right, sweet. So I got my traditional dish after coming out of the mountains, which is just beer and chicken wings. And, oh, yeah, I could drink at that time because I was only 19, but it was like,
well, you were
18 or 19 is the legal drinking age there. So, so yeah, I go and the Canadiens hockey team loses right at the end. Like people are flipping tables and shit. It's a big riot. So I'm outside observing and I just came out of the mountains. So, again, I look like a vagabond. And I had my big rucksack with me, so.
And a weapon.
Yeah, no, I left that in the truck, but.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Like, actually, no, I had a different weapon with me, and that's, ends up what gets me busted. But, yeah, the cops come over and they're like, je suis, je pa pa pa. I'm like, I don't understand French. Where are you from? The United States. Where's your passport? I don't have one. Where's your ID? I don't have one. You know, I was doing like the Christopher McCandless thing.
Yeah,
like,
full on McCandles or whatever. Yeah.
Who?
What was that?
Into the Wild.
Yeah.
That guy.
Oh, that's a great
book. He did the same thing.
Yeah, it was a great
Yeah,
movie.
He was like, you know, I was very idealistic at that time in my life. I had a lot of disdain for society and whatnot.
Did you burn all your Social Security
cards? I didn't go that far. But, yeah, I did go, like, without an ID card. I was like, who am I, you know?
Right.
But, yeah, so they're like, okay, hands against the wall. They start searching me. They found a little bit of weed in my jacket pocket because I had this little one-hitter I used to pack and smoke.
About what year was this?
This would have been 2008.
Okay,
I think.
So weed's still kind of not that acceptable.
Yeah, it wasn't very acceptable.
Yeah, I didn't mean to take you off that, off your train of thought.
But, no, no.
Yeah. But it helps.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, it would have been about 08. And, they searched me, found weed. So that was cause to search the rest of my rucksack. In my rucksack, I also had some mushrooms.
Oh, shit.
And so they searched the rest. And here's the kicker is when I was in the Adirondacks in the mountains, I had also borrowed my dad's pistol.
Oops.
Walther PPK. And for protection against
good,
bears.
Good choice.
Yeah. It's a nice one. James Bond used it.
Yeah.
So, but at that time, like looking back, yeah, I mean.
I'll just scare a bear respectfully.
Yeah. It's yeah. Looking back, it's. Not optimal bear repulsion, but
It'll make a noise, though.
Yeah. It'll make a noise.
If you hit it, it's going to hurt. I mean,
it will definitely hurt. It might piss it off. But, but yeah, and honestly, like up there, there are no grizzlies. It's just black bears. And now, I mean, at this point in my life, I've been around fucking thousands of black bears, like, because I used to pack horses and sequoia and everything. And, yeah, they're pretty, they just run off usually. Mm. But at that time, I was like, oh, I better have this for protection. And I didn't realize it was legal in New York, but I didn't realize just, and I knew it was not kosher to bring it into Canada, but I didn't realize how bad it is to bring a handgun into Canada. So I was arrested for trafficking small arms and given a prognosis of 3 to 5 years, which I was shitting my pants, dude. Like, I was supposed to go to West Point the next year, you know, like I had already been accepted to go to the U.S. Military Academy. I was a bright kid. I was supposed to have this future. And they're saying 3 to 5 years. And,
yeah, you're about to get a different kind of degree. Like,
oh man. Yeah, dude, it was scary. And,
of course you realize West Point's not that different from prison. Like,
it's a different kind of prison.
I mean, I only say that from a Citadel experience, but,
yeah, an interesting like dispose of the relationship between freedom and imprisonment, which we can get into more talking about Immanuel Kant and Karl Marx and the way they define freedom versus the way others, like whatever. I wrote an essay on it. But anyway, so I went to prison, and I went to the jail for like 2 or 3 days. Or 2 days, I think. They questioned me, blah, blah, blah. Then they sent me to a prison in Sorel, which is right outside of Montreal. And in the prison, I had, like, some pretty crazy experiences. Nothing, like, all that crazy, but and nothing happened to me. I was scared that stuff would happen to me. But
so you're a good-looking dude. I mean, you're also pretty fit, but, you know.
I'd do me.
So... Young buck shows up to French prison.
Yeah.
Bonjour.
And for some reason, like, I kept to myself, you know, and I didn't, ultimately, I didn't really have any problems. But, like, everybody wanted to practice their English with me. And for some reason, the prison was, like, riddled with meth heads, like, the dirtiest fucking meth heads. And nothing against, like,
methods.
Users of any kind, but these people were just sketchy. And for some reason,
were they still able to do meth in prison? So like,
no,
or were they like coming off meth in prison?
They were coming off meth in prison, and the only drugs that I personally saw in prison were weed. Somebody smuggled weed in one time. And when I was there, I wasn't there for that long, but somebody got weed in, and the guys in my wing all like got giddy on weed. It was hilarious. It was like the first time they'd ever smoked. Everybody, all these like big buff guys who bench press 350 and shit, they come out and they're like giggling and they're like, you know. So that was a pretty funny one.
I feel like weed would be hard to.
I feel like that would suck in prison because you can't just go to the store and get like snacks or something. Like,
yeah. Oh yeah, that too. But like it has such a distinct smell. Like you're not hiding that. Like if you're doing, gonna do like any
the
like
prison wallet, man.
But if you're gonna do pills or you're gonna do, you know, powders, whatever it is, like at least the entire wing doesn't smell like the devil's cabbage.
So distinct, yeah.
Right.
Lived in Hawaii for 10 years. Like, yeah, you know that one from anywhere.
Yeah, I lived in Boulder. You walk down the street, every other house is growing, you know. But, yeah, I met a dude. As I was getting out, he was like the most outgoing, rambunctious guy I think I've ever met. And he was hilarious, but I tend to be much more introverted.
Have you met David Lafargue?
Sorry. <Yeah.
laughs> Shout out.
Yeah, I tend to be like more introverted and reserved. And this dude was just like talking. And he spoke English quite well. And he's talking about like the first time his gang got him to smoke crack. And he's like, this is what I was like. And he turns around, comes back. You know, he's like, just like, you would have thought the dude was on crack then. We get these shitty sandwiches, which are just like two pieces of white bread and a piece of cheese. And he saves the saran wrapper or, you know, like the plastic wrapper. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you know what this is for? And I was like, yeah, I could guess. And he's like, you go out on the street, you come back into prison, you get arrested, whatever. You take a, How many do you say? Like 3 grams of crack? Up the pooper.
They call it keistering.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, man.
So are there gangs in Canadian prison?
Because
all I really know is like U.S. prison system with the black gangs, the Mexican gangs, and like the white gangs. So I'm curious.
Yeah. A funny thing about that
wild
is...
French-Canadian gangs.
Yeah, the French speakers and then... English speakers, or what do they got?
I think I was only one of...
Bikers.
There was one other American in the prison from Arizona named Mike, a big dude. And he kind of took me under his wing, like gave me orange soda for free from the commissary. That was cool, but I was like skeptical, you know.
Yeah. But what am I going to owe you for this?
What
is
this
later?
Cost?
Like, what is this going to cost me later?
But now he was cool. But everybody, so one thing I'll say is like, yeah, people here, Canada, and first off, it was a minimum security prison. So it wasn't like fucking the hardcore guys, although there was at least one murderer there named Stephen Lejeune. He taught me that because he said, do you know what that means? Lejeune. And I was like, no.
The day.
Yeah. So that's the first French I learned. Second French I learned. The first French I learned is Sus-ma-beat and Tarbanak. Sus-ma-beat, suck my dick.
Ah. So beat is, okay, I didn't know that term.
Apparently. Right. And Tarbanak, which is Quebec. So.
Wait, you didn't learn that the hard way, did you?
Unfortunately.
Oh, no.
No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, no. That took a weird turn.
Yeah. Layers of therapy are unraveling at this moment.
So how did you get out, or like how long were you in there? Like,
so I went after the couple days of jail, I went to the prison. I was there for 14 days before I had an arraignment, and at my arraignment trial or arraignment
hearing,
whatever the fuck it is, my lawyer, Miss Gale, who was smoking hot, she I think she convinced everybody else. And I think by that point, like people had questioned me, all the inspectors and stuff, they questioned me. I think they realized that I was just some dumb, naive kid trying to write poems in the mountains. And I wasn't like a fucking weapons trafficker,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So by the time my arraignment came, I think they were cool with letting me off. Aside from fining me a shitload. So they fined me a whole bunch of money. They impounded my truck, of course, and all my belongings. And
probably didn't get those guns back, huh?
I did get the rifle back.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I did get the 22 Magnum rifle that I had was no problem. That was legal there. But no, I did not get that back, which made for a very difficult discussion with my dad later. Yeah. When he found out.
Why is the serial number different?
Right.
I got you a new one.
Yeah. Why is it scratched off? Don't worry about it. But, so I did 14 days in that prison. They let me out, and they deported me back to the border immediately. I'm not allowed to go to Canada anymore. Yeah. Although I would like to jump like the chief, you know, and BC and stuff. Ski there. I am technically allowed to apply for amnesty. I think after like 3 years. I just haven't gone through the process yet. But They deported me back to the border, but it was still winter time, and they confiscated all my gear, all my clothes and everything, except for what I was wearing. So it was freezing. I had to hitchhike back like 300 miles back to Rochester, where I lived, or where my parents lived. And so that was like
they knew
its
that
own ordeal.
The whole time? Like, did
they had
a phone
no
call?
Idea at the time.
Surprise! I'm home. Yeah, my parents are not my first call if I go to prison. Like, that's not my first call.
At least
call.
Not this at this point. Maybe now, yeah. But
yeah,
like,
sorry, Brian, I'm calling you.
Yeah, I can't even remember if I even used my phone call or not. We did have
a
pay phone. We had a pay phone in the wing that I was. So I was actually in
you
two
got
different
international
wings.
International charges.
Yeah. Right. Can I call collect? yeah, but the book that I wrote takes place from when I left Rochester into the Adirondack Mountains. So it takes place like living off the land in the Adirondack Mountains, getting arrested in Canada, going to prison there, and then hitchhiking back home. So it all only takes place over the course of about 1 month.
Wow.
But it's called The Prison Chronicles, and I used a nom de plume to use the French phrase.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
D.K. Lawrence was the name I used. Devin Lawrence Kelly is my name, but I thought D.K. Lawrence sounded fancy at the time. Yeah. So
you start writing romance novels.
Yeah, I've written some romantic shit, man. I've written a lot of poems.
Is there, and I don't need the link now, but if I put a link in the show notes, would people be able to like pick it up?
Yeah, nice. Yeah, no problem.
Nice, I'll get that link from you after.
If it's on Amazon, I can't control the price, but if it's from the publisher, then it's whatever the price is.
Well, I'll do my best to get the publisher's link, because we have other friends that have written books, and they get... we're not allowed to use the R word when it comes to what Amazon does to authors. It's
oh, that's right. We're not allowed to use that word. Please cut that out later.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll beep it.
Beep.
But, yeah, Amazon screws you hard as a writer. So I'll try and get the other link.
Cool.
But,
I think it's a good book, you know, like, I'm 34 now, and I look back and I think, like, parts of me kind of cringe, but I wrote it with a specific philosophy. I wrote it with this specific philosophy in mind that art, like, writing is art. At least this style of writing was art for me, and art needs to kind of be preserved and encapsulated in the time and place that it was. So that's what pushed me to publish at that time. I published it like a year later. I did go to West Point and worked on it while I was there and ended up publishing it during my plebe year, which pissed off a lot of people.
Yeah, I didn't have time to write a book. My knob year is what they called it, but same idea. But yeah. But your 20s your teens and 20s should be cringy. Like, cause you're just figuring out how to be a human.
Just watch any of your, like, old GoPro videos. They're all cringy.
You want to see my track off high nose?
Yeah. Check out this
track. Best track ever. Epic.
When you watch it, and you're like, oh.
That's why I don't even wear a camera anymore.
Yeah, I haven't filmed a... Yeah.
But, yeah, that's tight.
Everything gets better with age.
Yeah. Yeah, your 20s should be cringy. I'm proud of you for... So you took some shit in school for publishing a book?
Yeah. Yeah, the upperclassmen were like, you know, giving me shit. They're like, oh, Kelly, you know, Cadet Kelly thinks he's fucking hot shit because he published a book, blah, 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 all that stuff.
No, I'm hot shit because I was in fucking French prison.
Yeah.
I fuck you up.
Yeah, West Point ain't shit compared to French prison.
Yeah. Hey, one guy... Okay, yeah, I had this...
Canadian prison, sorry.
Sorry, French-Canadian.
French-Canadian, yeah. One in the same. No, just kidding. Sorry, French people.
Not if you ask a Frenchman.
Yeah, I had this, like, I think she was a cow, like a junior. Not a cow, sorry. That sounds derogatory, but that's what they call your junior year.
Oh,
it's cow
know
year.
Huh.
Yeah.
Cow year.
So it's like a
what's
plebe.
Your senior year?
Firsty.
What are they? Yeah,
firsty. So it's a plebe, yearling, or yuck, cow, and firsty.
Okay.
So freshman, sophomore, junior, mm-hmm. or senior. But, yeah, I had this, like, she wasn't my CO, but she was, like, something, whatever. And
corrections officer?
Yeah, she was teasing. Something that was, like, she really didn't like me. And her boyfriend at the time went out of his way to write a scathing review on Amazon and of the book. So it was, like, yeah. Whatever.
Those are the best. Like, I love the people that get angry and just get online and write reviews. Like, if you ever want to be entertained, like, I might take some shit for this, but go to Skydive Hawaii's reviews on Yelp. They are so entertaining. They're either like the best thing ever or like not. but if you've been there and worked there, like, you can't help but just.
I recently heard a quote from David Goggins. He said, "You'll never be hated on by somebody who's doing better in life than you are."
Yeah. Goggins is great. Like, he's one of those guys that makes me like want to be less of a piece of shit and like do work. You know, like,
not me. I could live without it.
Yeah.
He turns me off.
Sorry.
Yeah, but I think regardless of individual opinion, I still think, like, objectively, to a certain degree, it's, like, objective how respectable the amount of shit that dude's done mm-hmm. is, you know?
Yep. And I think there's something in suffering that makes you better, and that it's the times when you are suffering that... you know, it's that whole, like, how do you make a diamond, you know, that whole analogy.
Hmm.
And, like, my favorite, line from, the Citadel Prayer is, "And suffer if need be." And I used to always take that as like a, like, well, yeah, if you need to suffer, then you just do it. But now that I'm much older and I look at it, I was like, no, like, you need to suffer in order to be better or grow or come out the other side, like, because you always come out the other side better, you know? So I don't know, it's one of those.
Yeah, to some degree, it's sort of been a life ethos for me. Not that I seek suffering all the time, but what
says
I mean,
the guy that's gonna have to hike back up to Sandy's place.
right
stay hard. But like, I think I'm grateful for having suffered in my younger years. I wrestled, and wrestling is incredibly brilliant. Difficult. And then on top of just the physicality of it and the workouts and everything, I mean, I was putting in multiple other workouts just to lose weight. Some of those included plastic suits on the stair stepper in a sauna, jumping rope in the sauna. Like, I mean, I've literally passed out from dropping weight, and I don't think it's necessary, and I would hope it's not necessary for everybody, because it fucking sucks. But it did shape me, mm-hmm. and it was a very formative experience in my life. I ended up going on to wrestle at West Point as well, and and then I coached afterward, and like, I mean, wrestling as a sport or an art, it was my first love. So I look at it quite differently than the outside world might see wrestling as. They might see it as some brutish sport, but it's really like a dance. It's like a really, it's all about precision, timing, technique.
Wrestling with dudes in their underwear. And,
oh yeah.
No, sorry. So no, I'm with you. I, as
proper
you,
dance.
You know,
check the oil.
That's actually a very effective method.
It works.
Like one of my favorite things outside of base jumping is UFC and MMA and watching the understanding the weight cut, because I didn't wrestle growing up, but you just see a different kind of human that can go through that. And how much weight were you cutting?
Okay, so when I was 16, I dropped the most 15 and 16. I dropped the most amount of weight ever, I dropped from 128 pounds to 103. And keep in mind,
how long were you doing that?
About a month it took me. And but keep in mind that I was already lean at 128.
Yeah.
And
so you're managing water at that point.
Yeah, and I mean, there's extra stuff too. There's a whole science behind it, the water weight. Here's how fucked it was. So I weighed in. I had to weigh out for a tournament, and I weighed 125.1 pounds, and I had to drop 0.1. So I put a plastic suit on with all my winter gear. Jackets, hats, everything. And so I started running and jumping rope. I did that for 1 hour. I didn't lose 0.1.
Did you shave your head?
So that's what I did one time. One time my coaches were walking me up to the scale because I couldn't really stand on my own that well. And so they were keeping me kind of balanced to get on the scale. I was 0.1 over, and we cut my hair and obviously dropped your underwear. And because the underwear itself didn't make up for that, but cutting my hair did. And after that I just started, it's what hunger does to you, the concept of hunger, it gave me such a better kind of perspective or appreciation for the horrendous things that humanity is capable of doing and has done to other people throughout history. But hunger changes you. When you go through hunger, there are different stages. At first, you would kill for, just a pizza or whatever, a good meal. But then you get to a point where you would kill just for a banana. And then you get to a point where you would kill just for, and then dehydration on top of it, you would kill just for a sip of water. And, I was going through high school at this time, and my friends would be oh, I'm dying of thirst. Can I have your Coca-Cola? And I'd be dude, you have no idea what that means, because when you're that thirsty, when your mouth is that dry and stuff, the syrup in Coca-Cola sticks, it coagulates, you can't even swallow it barely, and it does nothing to assuage hunger. You need water. So I was going through high school I had this totally different perspective than a lot of my peers, because I was literally dying for water, and my body was eating itself. And you can tell, because when I was losing that amount of weight, my body was eating it into its own muscle. And then you start, your breath goes into ketosis, and you start you have ketones coming out of your, you can smell it in your breath, sort of. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of sickening that a teenager would have to go through that kind of thing voluntarily. So I don't condone it, but I will say it was, to this day, the hardest mental thing I've ever had to do. And then on top of that, we had all the physicality of the wrestling practices and workouts on as well. But mentally, it was so hard, and that was such a formative experience for me, and kind of shaped my outlook on life through subsequent years, I would say for the better, in that I had this different perspective, and I used that kind of to my advantage.
Like it gave you like a different like range of what's possible. You're like, all right, well, no matter what's going on, like, it's not as bad as that.
Yeah.
Right.
You're going to eat tonight.
Right. Eventually, I did run into things that were harder in certain ways, but that was, like, my baseline. And it's like Dan Gable, the classic wrestling icon, said...
Make a grip after him.
Oh, yeah, for sure, dude. The Gable grip, man, that's one of my favorite moves. Yeah, once you wrestled, everything else in life is easy. Now, I don't agree with that. It's still fucking hard sometimes, the shit we do in life. But I agree with the sentiment behind it that once you've wrestled, you have a different baseline. And you've already done shit that's really hard and tested you such that you can develop a sense of confidence in conflict or in difficult situations.
From when you stepped on the scale to the time you went onto the mat, what was that turnaround time? Because like you have to rehydrate, and there has to be a time, like there's a point of diminishing returns, right, in performance. And the whole reason you cut weight is to essentially weigh more than your opponent and have an advantage, right? Generally, I'm probably over
To a degree, if there's a team aspect involved, like in high school wrestling, mm-hmm. I was wrestling on the same team as the number like one and two guys in the country.
Right, but what was the turnaround time between like weigh-ins to wrestling?
Turnaround in high school for me when I was wrestling was we would weigh in. The way it worked for me was we would have two-day tournaments. So they would start Friday evening after school, and you would go through like the first two rounds of a bracket, and then you would have the finals, like the quarterfinals, semis, and finals on Saturday.
So weigh-ins were on
Friday. So weigh-ins were Friday, and
the first two rounds that evening.
Right, and so I would be incredibly sucked out.
Yeah.
Like, I would do horrendous physically. I was fucking terrible.
Of course,
I mean,
everybody else was too, theoretically.
Not necessarily, because not like I was losing a lot of weight. Like mm-hmm. it was different than there weren't too many people losing the same amounts of weight that I was, but I was more skilled than they were. So the first two rounds were because you're ranked or seeded into the bracket.
Yeah, so you're like 1 versus 16.
Yeah, so I would be against guys that I could confidently beat even on my worst day. And I just had to get through Friday night. And then when I was wrestling, you had to weigh out 1 pound heavier. So I was like my senior year, 125. You weigh out Friday night at 126. And then you could fucking dine. Like, you could feast, dude. We would feast. Man, one time I gained 14 pounds in 22 hours. Wow. Like, Jesus. And I was small, too. Like, I went from 105, I think, to 121 or something.
That's like me and Brian in a weekend in Italy or somewhere, like drinking and eating and jumping.
Yeah, dude. Oh, man, there's nothing like it. Like, yeah, and then I felt just as bad, but on the other side of the scale. But like, so basically the goal was weigh in, be super sucked out, wrestle for through the first two rounds or whatever it was against relatively easy guys, and then you'd weigh out, and then you weigh out and you can fucking feast, and then you come in the next day like 10 pounds heavier and hydrated, sort of, because it does take time to get full hydration mm-hmm. back, but more hydrated. And even just that little bit of water, like even a little bit of water does worlds for you, both psychologically and physically, when you're that dehydrated. And then we would have final, or like quarterfinals, semis, finals. Mm. So yeah, and then by the time finals were, that was like 26 hours later or something.
Nice. That's so interesting to me. We didn't even have high school wrestling where I went to school.
It's a shame.
Neither did we.
Yeah, but
I really do think it's such a beautiful sport for various reasons. Of course, I'm biased, but yeah, it's really an incredible thing. In the same way, or a similar way, that I also have a huge respect for jiu-jitsu as an art, as a martial art. I would say that jiu-jitsu is a little bit more art than martial. It's still martial, you know, but like wrestling is a little bit more martial than art. But there's a lot of overlap there, such that like a couple years ago, I had never had jiu-jitsu training. I'd never taken a jiu-jitsu class. I was living in Colombia in Bogota, the capital, and I rolled with the Colombian national champion, and he and I went 50-50. Like, I tapped him out, he tapped me out, I tapped him out, he tapped me out. But he was the national champion of Colombia, and me with just wrestling background was able to roll with him safely, you know.
Nice. Yeah, so I didn't plan to go here, but like I did karate and jiu-jitsu, like Japanese jiu-jitsu, in high school, junior high and high school. And like I said, we didn't have wrestling at my high school, and these were the early days of like UFC and MMA, like the first ones. UFC was the first one was like 91, 92, and I was in high school by 97, 96, 97. But it was the baby, the infancy. And like I would take the karate class and I would take the jiu-jitsu class, and because my logic was like, back then they would argue, which is better, the striking sports or the grappling sports? I was like, well, learn both and don't worry about it. And I almost switched high schools to be on the wrestling team because I felt like, other than like Hoist Gracie, like Dan Severn was like crushing it, and he was a wrestler, and other guys came along like Mark Coleman. And you could see that there was something about the wrestling. If you had that wrestling base, like, you were going to be very successful. Obviously did not go into a career in martial arts or the U.S. or any MMA. But in high school, I worked at a grocery store, and I had friends from other schools. And our rival high school, who I had friends at because we all worked at the same store, they got a wrestling team. And we were at a friend's house party, and I loved it. We were like, they wanted to like try their stuff out, and I'm like, yeah, let's do this. Like, let's roll. And but it was a different philosophy, a different mentality. Like in wrestling, you kind of want to be on top, and in jiu-jitsu, it doesn't really matter. You can be on bottom and still choke somebody out, and these dudes would like grab my wrist and I'd be like, okay, that's fine, you can have that. And then they would like go for my leg and be like, sure, you can have that too. And when they went for my leg, they'd let go of my wrist, and then I'd put them in a guillotine and then it was over, because they didn't know it. But because we had different mindsets about what we were trying, and we also did not have any sort of defined, you know, rules, because we were at high school party. So yeah, I choked out a lot of my friends just because we had different mindsets.
But that's the trap a lot of wrestlers fall into, is getting guillotined because of our shots. Jiu-jitsu guys are notoriously terrible at takedowns, at least from the perspective of a wrestler.
Please take me down.
right. And there's no reason to be good at takedowns necessarily in jiu-jitsu because, you can just pull guard. But when you then step up to MMA, there is reason.
There's levels of this shit, you know. Yeah. Typically, you don't want to be on your back in MMA.
Yeah,
and the Jew Bear.
When you watch the UFC these days, so a couple of my friends from wrestling are in the UFC, or have been, and like in the early days, like you were talking about, yeah, wrestlers used to dominate. The wrestling foundation was kind of the dominant foundation to have. But these days you seriously like need to be good at fucking everything. And these guys are so good at everything. Like they're world class in every single discipline. And that's what normal people don't understand. Like, oh man, like one of my friends, Gregor Gillespie, was in the UFC.
No kidding.
Yeah. He was a training partner of mine in high school for wrestling.
No kidding.
Yeah. And dude, this dude was untouchable in wrestling. So fast and so technical. And he went on to win the Division I national championships in wrestling and then trained again like a maniac, learning striking, jiu-jitsu, all the other stuff you need for MMA. And I mean, he's a phenom, but the thing that people don't get is like how fucking good these guys are in those top ranks. People think like, oh, you know, I could take him in this or that. I'm a boxer, you know, whatever. It's like, dude, these guys in the top ranks, it's like NFL athletes, you know, like they're just on a different level with the explosiveness and the strength that they have. And the, and then you add to that technique. And I mean, like I had a stint in mixed martial arts. I was living in Nicaragua and training horses on the beach for $1 an hour. And which was a good wage in Nicaragua, but it's not really some, but I was dating a girl at the time who was from Germany, but her father was Colombian. She wanted to meet her Colombian family. So we wanted to fly to Colombia and we couldn't really earn plane tickets on working for $1 an hour. So I was like, oh, I'll just do some mixed martial arts fighting. They had a big scene of cage fighting, like underground sort of, where guys would bet, you know, and you could get a decent chunk of money if you did okay. So with my wrestling background, I was like, oh yeah, I'll do some mixed martial arts fights. And in Nicaragua, the big sports, at least for MMA, are judo and taekwondo. And man, I would see these taekwondo guys warming up backstage, the kicks they would throw,
like the high
terrifying
kicks
and the, yeah. Terrifying, like so fast, so powerful, because I'm not a kicker, you know, I don't know how to kick really. I did learn some basic like low kicks to chop them down and keep them on their feet, but I'm not a striker. I was a wrestler. And
charge them.
Yeah, so
while that leg's in the air, then yeah.
Sort of, like, yeah, it, but dude, like, it just takes one to get caught, yeah. And you're done, and so it was pretty scary. I mean, as a wrestler, yeah, my philosophy was to stay just out of kicking range, like 5-6 feet away, and then close the gap super fast with some sort of, like, combination of, like, a fake and a quick movement, close the gap. Once I'm chest to chest or like once I'm up close, I was very comfortable as a wrestler. I did end up doing like really well, but, I wasn't in the UFC, you know, like, in the UFC, everybody is top tier at everything. Single discipline. And that's just, it's a different level. Like people don't realize how fucking world, like even you take, guys who aren't known for whatever skill, like Khabib, people say like, oh, Khabib is a shit striker. It's like, no, the dude is a world-class striker compared to you. You
know, right, yeah, like, yeah, yeah. Like, yeah, compared to the Cheeto fingers, yeah, the guy right? Sitting on his couch, like, yeah.
Yeah, he's saying his first rodeo, yeah. You know, like, yeah.
That's wild. Dude, yeah, I wanted to, yeah, you just touched on, cause I had two notes here to talk about, like the being a cowboy in South America. And now I didn't even realize you did MMA fights in South America. And I feel like there's so much, we've got more layers to pull back.
the onion is
And big. You're going to have to
save it for the next time.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he's got to go back up the mountain.
Yeah,
you and you're not taking a Toofly or anything.
There's no train, so.
But so what I love is that bass brings us together, but it's the individual stories that I learn about through meeting people. Sometimes on our way to exits, or you know, when we're hiking up to Sandy's, or you know, hanging out. And so thank you for sharing that, these stories with us. We've got more layers. Like I want to do this again.
Yeah, man. We're only up to age like 24.
Right.
Me,
I was
man.
Like, I'm like, why have you not written another book by now? Just from the stuff I've heard here. Like, that's so cool. But I do want to be respectful of what daylight we have left here and that you have to get up the mountain.
And, hour and a half hike that you have to do. Because how long does it take you to get up there?
Yeah, hour and a half maybe.
Yeah.
I would say.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, Devin, thank you so much for for hanging out with us and doing a recording.
I think it's really cool what you're doing.
Thanks.
Because as you say,
trying to get back on the rails. You know?
Yeah, yeah. As you say, one of my favorite things about bass as a lifestyle and as a sport, like what brought me into this lifestyle is, and what I've learned is just how intricate and interesting other people's stories are beyond bass, mm-hmm. like outside of the world of bass, because we always connect over like, oh, I jumped this jump today, and oh, how do you jump this one, you know, like,
yeah.
And but the people that you meet in this sport are so interesting, and we all have histories, we all have like so many cool stories and stuff to share. So it's really cool that you're making an effort to kind of spread those.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I would say there for because there was a bit of a gap there in recordings, and you know, the life sort of got in the way of the bass, if you will. And I'm trying to reprioritize some things and just figure it out and still give the community and anybody that was listening to this, like hoping to hear about actual bass jumping, sorry, you know, but sometimes we talk about bass, but
you did a sweet Lemoose today. So
I did
bass
a
jumping.
Sick track from Lemoose.
Bass jumping.
Nice. Let's see the video.
Check mark.
Yeah. Brian got the exit because Brian was nice enough to walk out there with me.
Yeah. Hiked back from Lemoose.
Yeah.
Terrible.
It's not even a fun hike to Lemoose.
That's my favorite hike. That's my favorite one.
Yeah.
It's like walking through the magic forest. Like
the walk back is not cool.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Magic is gone by the time you have to walk back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there have been times where I'm like looking at like nuke and winds and other conditions, and I'm like,
I'd take the winds.
Yeah, I was like, I'll take that over hiking back. But I have hiked back from Yellow, which is more or less the same hike, but and I didn't enjoy it. And I resented. I followed somebody else's decision, and I'll stick with it.
And that was your base jumping section for the last hour and a half.
Sometimes you walk back because somebody else doesn't feel good about it,
and that's okay.
Yeah, and that's
you're
fine.
Still here to
not
talk about
yet.
That.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, quick side note, man, it's been a rough week, huh?
Mm.
For base.
Well, it's summertime.
Yeah.
Post COVID, everybody's able to travel again.
Yeah.
Shit happens.
Stay safe.
Yeah. Do your best, make good decisions. And so before I close, I wanted to say good night, Steve, which is an inside thing. Met a guy that listens to the podcast today that listens to this before he goes to bed because I don't know. Long story short, I just wanted to close this with goodnight, Steve, because
it's awesome.
He's probably going to listen to this at some
point.
That's
cute. That's very cute.
Goodnight, Steve.
Yeah, it's nice meeting people that actually listen. It's like,
Steve, sweet dreams.
Yeah. Good dude. I'm hoping
Brian will be whispering into his ear.
He's already asleep.
Yeah.
Goodnight, Steve.
Night, night. All right. This has been a Bass Life Podcast. We're out. All right. If you want to know more about our guests, just check out the show notes. And if you want to give us some feedback or reach out to us, you can hit us at baselife2014@gmail.com, facebook.com/thebaselife, and on Instagram, we're @base.life. All right. Thanks.